This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Emily Rooney. Well, there just has to be some jitters among the Democratic bigwigs today as the second presidential debate is set for tomorrow night at Hofstra University on Long Island. The Obama campaign has been leaking tactics all weekend, promising that they're going to come on strong. Of course, to that, Mitt Romney says it's not going to matter. Nevertheless, the president is still reeling from his performance of 10 days ago. There's 3 weeks left. No national opinion polls have Obama ahead right now. But the swing states are still key. And right now, Obama has a lead in Ohio and a couple others. It's politics as usual today. I am joined here in the studio by Charlie Baker, entrepreneur and residence at General Catalyst Partners and former Republican candidate for governor. And Shannon O'Brien, former Massachusetts state treasurer and a former candidate for governor on the Democratic ticket. Can't wait to have your input from both of you. I mean, as two people who participated in numerous debates, both in primary and general elections, I mean, first of all, Charlie, and either one of you, when you have finished a debate, do you have a good sense of how well or how poorly you've done? Because I think in this case, Obama had absolutely no sense that he hadn't done well until people started telling him. And I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall to see how they delivered that news. You know?
Me too. I think generally speaking, certainly the debates I participated in, I had a pretty decent idea of whether I did well or whether I thought the folks I was debating against did well. And the big issue, Emily, is it's hard to tell what's going to stick afterwards. I mean, you sort of finish this thing and you say, well, I did pretty good well on this. I did pretty well on this. I wish I'd done better on that. They did well on this. But you have no idea how the media and how the public is actually going to decide what they thought was important that got said during the course of the discussion.
Does it surprise you what some of the things people focus on? Because I can imagine some of it must be a blur to you. You don't even remember exactly everything and how it was said or even the questions that were asked.
I think I can probably tell you the questions that got asked in every debate I
really?
Was in. Yeah.
Could you share?
Certainly certain sticks in my brain, I'll tell you that.
You know, for the most part, but you know, the difference is you can walk out knowing whether or not you have accomplished what your team, your strategic team told you to do. And my guess is that Obama came off doing exactly what they said to do. Don't be mean. Don't engage. Don't belittle. Be presidential. And I think that him looking down was his way of not looking up and sneering every time he heard Mitt Romney saying something that he felt was less than truthful. But if he walked off thinking he did a good job, it's my sense that the team gave him a strategy. He thought he executed it. And that doesn't always mean that people watching the debate are going to think that you won. But in your mind as a candidate, when you have that strategy and you think you've accomplished it, that's how you walk out thinking you're a success.
All right, I'll say
this.
And
you may not be.
So rope-a-dope strategy when somebody's coming out and actually swinging and hitting, eventually you need to swing back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But Charlie, but don't you find, I mean, again, as a candidate, if you've been told, be nice, be nice, be nice, don't be mean, it's sometimes hard. I mean, I think back to, I think it was Newt Gingrich who said, it's really hard, or maybe it was John McCain, it's really hard to debate against someone who's not. It's one of those white-haired Republican guys who have debated against Mitt Romney who say it's very difficult to debate someone when they're not telling the truth. And it is very hard, especially when you're trying to be nice, when you're focused on what is the truth, what's not the truth, rather than arguing your point of view. That's a difficult ballet to because you saw what happened with Joe Biden. He was looking at what he saw was less than truthful positions, and he lasted.
Shannon, just for the record, the notion that somehow the Republicans have a corner on untruthfulness and debate performance. I mean, I used to sit there tearing my hair out when I watched Bill Weld negotiate John Kerry, because literally every second word that came out of his mouth.
I'm not
was
talking Bill Weld and John
true.
Kerry. I'm talking
no,
this specific candidacy.
But I think the goal of anybody going into a debate is to frame their message in a way that they believe maximizes their likelihood for success in trying to make a point. And you want to do it in a way that's honest and truthful.
Right.
But fundamentally, you know, just watching this as an outsider, having now been an insider in the course of all this, there's an unbelievable amount of work that goes on both sides to argue that the other side is full of it. And I would argue that, you know, there's some truth in all of that.
Yeah, exactly.
And the voters get stuck having to
even the truth squads don't agree, Shannon.
Well, even the truth squads don't agree, but I will tell you that I do think that there is a qualitative difference between, I mean, the fact that Eric Fernstrom said you know, earlier on in the campaign, Etch-a-Sketch. And there's a reason for that. It's we are changing what we're going to be saying. We're changing our talking points and our and where we stand on healthcare. When the fact is you hear every other day they are walking back what it is Mitt Romney says. I'm sorry. There is a qualitative difference between what he says in front of what Mitt Romney says in front of what audience and what
Shannon,
he says in front of another audience.
That had nothing to do with, no. Obama's poor performance. He lacked passion, polish.
I don't disagree.
Nothing to do with the fact that Mitt Romney might have been changing his position.
I don't disagree, but I think that what the Democratic viewers wanted him to do was to call him on every single time that he said something that was less than truthful or something that completely contradicted what he said several times or dozens of times earlier in the campaign. I think that people were
especially
coming out of their
seats. Especially if you could find one where you could take him out of context, because those are always most effective, I think.
Well,
you know, I'll say this, if you won't, Shannon.
Pre-existing conditions.
When in the last debate that you had that was moderated by Tim Russert, there was a joke you made about a tattoo. Would you like to see my tattoo? Were you surprised by the fact that that went down so poorly? I mean, that was the thing that got picked up. It was a joke, and it was like,
yeah, you know, and
Russert was admonishing you, and
yeah, he was kind of wagging his finger at me because I wasn't taking seriously the question that he had not yet posited.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's what happens is, you know, you make a lame joke. You know, we've seen other candidates do it, and that was one of those things that I paid a huge price for. But the real issue in that campaign and in that debate, rather, was whether or not Mitt Romney was telling the truth about whether or not he was going to be pro-choice, and ultimately that's what came back against me is I was being I was being too aggressive. The issue is choice, and I was saying he wasn't
telling you. How old can you be to have a tattoo?
But he was saying he was going to be solidly pro-choice, that he was a man of his word, and he should be taken at his word. And the fact is, you know, the history shows that he was not telling the truth, and I was.
But I do think some of those things end up being a function as much of style as they are anything else.
Sure.
Somebody after the vice president's debate, I don't remember who it was, said if you read the transcript, you probably thought it was a draw. If you listened to it on the radio, you probably thought Biden won. If you watched it on TV, you might have come away thinking that Ryan won.
Right.
And that was purely a function, not so much of what
that's
people were saying, but the way they looked, the way they were behaving and the way they looked.
That's fair.
Yeah. Joe Biden with the Cheshire cat grinning and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. Yeah.
So it's I kept getting told over and over again, Charlie, stop being so serious. You're as serious as a heart attack. Will you please just smile once?
But see, this is one of those things, Charlie, again, I'm sure to get back to my original point, is that your team sort of looks at you and they tell you, and translating into the smirk versus the smile, translating into, I mean, I remember one of the first times that I met Deval Patrick, and he was listening in a very thoughtful way to whatever the heck it was I was saying, which probably made no sense to begin with, but he frowned. And he had this, he used to scrunch up his whole face.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to him, think about that. Watch your face. Because I know in talking to you that you're being very thoughtful.
Yeah.
You're listening to me. But you look angry. And that's one of those things that it's very hard to unlearn these kind of natural mannerisms. So again, my original point is I think they told the president to do something. And I think that those physical mannerisms, those are the hardest ones that you have to train for and watch yourself because you don't even know you're doing it.
So one of my votes on that is I actually like the sitting down format better than the standing up format.
Yeah.
I think the standing up format leads to a lot of, you know, finger wagging and sort of point making. Whereas if you're sitting this far away from somebody, it really will be much more like a conversation with a moderator.
That's what I say when I have people on my television show and people say, why didn't you this and why didn't you that and why didn't you hammer on this? And I said, you're sitting shoulder to shoulder with people. It's much more difficult to say, rather than you're standing there behind that podium with the big box sort of protecting.
And the funny thing is, having gone through this debate prep, I mean, it comes down to almost absurd things. Like you will use your hand, you know, making a chopping motion. No, curl your fingers up together and hold them thusly, which looks less. I mean, honest to God, it comes down to this, and I can see some people doing these hand motions and go, I know where they learned that.
Really?
I mean, it gets down to that because again, it's what you look like. Almost less than what it is you say that has a huge impact on these television debates.
You know, I heard a piece on NPR, I think it was on Friday afternoon, which I had never thought of this recently because, yes, debates move the elections one way or another, but this report was saying this one more so than ever because we have become this nation of contestants, you know, American Idol and Survivor and
Absolutely.
Vote for me now.
Yeah.
Who won? You know, it's just like it's this game show kind of approach to presidential elections. So it's like,
well, just think of all the just because
I know, but you think about,
you know?
Well, why should it matter who speaks better? You know, is it like the old thing? Some people are better at getting jobs than they are at doing them. So if somebody is more forceful or more presentable or whatever it is, why would that matter if you believed in the ideology or the positions of one person or another? But it does.
I do think that when you're talking about public office, you know, having you know, interviewed for the job in the private sector, having interviewed for the job in the public sector, they're very different processes. But I do think that when you're running for an elective office, one of the things people are trying to gauge is your ability to publicly persuade, which is a totally different game.
Yes, it is.
Than leading an organization that
persuading
has kind of a, where everybody kind of has a defined mission and you're all chasing whatever it is you're trying to get done. Whereas When you're in public office, a big piece of what you need to learn how to do is to speak in a language and in a way and on terms that can that a broad swath of the populace can sort of understand and be moved by. And I think that's really different.
In the private,
which is why it matters so much.
In the private sector, when you're a CEO, you're the boss. When you're a president, you know, or a governor, you're really, you kind of hold the title that you're the big boss, but you're really not. There are so many other little interests and little people that can undermine exactly what you do. You know, one legislator, one senator, you know, it can make a huge difference in terms of getting your agenda through. So it's very, very different, you know, and that job performance, how you get that done is absolutely very, very different than being a CEO.
Okay, so tomorrow night, it's a town hall forum. Candy Crowley from CNN is going to be moderating it, but it's largely questions from the audience, which is a whole other ballgame because they can get very, you know,
boxers or briefs,
or even, you know, or religious or this. But I heard a report this morning. I'm not sure how accurate it is that the Candy is going to do a little bit more than that. She's going to be more than just a traffic director. She's going to have to come up with some of her own stuff. But so just put yourself in either one of you for a minute in the president's position. Maybe harder for you, but what would you do, Charlie, knowing that you had bombed the last time? What would you do differently?
Well, I think one of the things I would do is I would spend some time, you know, doing dress rehearsals, and I mean literally, you know, standing in a big room on a stage and have a bunch of people in the audience who I don't know and who I may never see again ask me a whole bunch of questions that I'm not expecting or anticipating, and being required by my team to to execute on the process and to answer them. I mean, I think this is a much tougher format than than a two-way conversation with a moderator. Yeah, because you have absolutely no idea what's coming at you, and you have no idea what kind of frame it's going to come at you.
And by the
way,
who actually poses the questions here? Because that also has an impact on
much
the audience gets involved. Is it the person who gets up?
I think it's the person who stands up.
Which I kind of hate because
they're all pre-screened.
They don't generally ask the questions very well either. They kind of go off.
It's a terrible
format. Well, I'll give you an example. You know, one of the things both of these guys have always had trouble with, or at least people have said they have trouble with, is this whole notion of kind of personal empathy. They're both viewed as sort of kind of cool customers, which I think they are. And in some respects, that's probably not a bad thing given the job that they're involved in. But you could have a lot of people come up and ask really personal questions on which they have very personal ties. So somebody stands up and says, I lost somebody on 9/11 and wants to talk about terrorism.
Right.
I mean, that's not going to, the text, that you're not going to respond to that the same way you might answer that if it got asked by a
absolutely
moderator
not.
Who just said, let's talk about what's going on in the Middle East or something like that. And I think, frankly, that's where, you know, these guys will be most tested, which is can they demonstrate
concern?
I mean, Bill Clinton was the master at this type of a forum because he could make you feel like you were the only person in the world when he would answer your question.
And I can give my own experience. I remember that was one of the toughest questions I had to answer when we did Romney and I did a debate out in Worcester. And the question was sort of, you know, how has a personal tragedy colored your life? And I'm sitting here going, damn, I've had a really good life and haven't really had, you know, I mean, I've lost family members, but there's been no sort of unforeseen illness or anything. And knowing that Mitt Romney's wife had multiple sclerosis, And so sitting there, how do I even answer this question? How do I say my 90-year-old grandmother passed away? No. You know what I mean? It just doesn't compare. That was, I thought, the hardest question that I had to answer. And I basically said, you know, I have been pretty blessed. I have been pretty lucky. But meeting the people out there who have been faced by tragedy and sort of bring that to the fore. But it was hard. I mean, what do you say?
You know? Who do you think this format favors? Shannon, do you think one or the other?
You know, I'm not sure because, as Charlie just referenced, it is the practice. And I don't think that Obama has practiced enough this year. I mean, Romney has had the benefit.
He's been in a million town halls.
He's been in a lot of debates.
Yeah.
And I've said,
and
it's,
town
it's,
halls.
But it's like a muscle. But a town hall is different than a debate, too. I mean, and he's had that ability to kind of get up and to hone it and to figure out what those answers are going to be and to just repeat them. You don't want to be thinking ever when you're a debate, whether it's one-on-one or whether it's a town hall. You have to be so prepared to just say what you're going to say.
Yeah.
Thinking is not a good
thing.
Forget
the question.
Yeah, thinking is not a good thing.
Here's an example of how the town hall thing, you know, and somebody had to point this out to me. We did a ton of town halls when we were campaigning, but after one of them early on, thankfully not at the end, somebody came up to me and said, look, when you answered that question, you spoke entirely and completely to the person who asked the question, even though once you got past the part that was specific to what they were asking about and started to talk about the larger issue, you probably should have stepped back at that point and sort of turned on your heels and said to the room, okay, folks, here's why this really good question should matter to you, and then speak more broadly to the entire audience.
That's a good one. But it's practicing
and
that helps.
You need to like walk through this a few times people say, you know, you really don't get the format you're in here, and this is how you need to start thinking about
because
it.
Because for as many times as these guys are in front of the camera, you know, as many times as they've actually done town hall, this is a very, very different situation. And they're really, you forget, they're really just guys. They're really just human beings who think and react and talk, and just like anybody does sitting around a table or even in front of a crowd like that.
Talking to two former gubernatorial candidates, Charlie Baker and Shannon O'Brien. So, to what degree do you think this whole Libya attack issue is going to be creating problems for President Obama? Fox News, as you probably know, has been hammering the issue all weekend long. In fact, Chris Wallace had a Mitt Romney aide on yesterday, Ed Gillespie, and he was challenging him.
There are a lot of questions from independent people. How do you pay for it? And you refuse to say how you're going to pay for
it. What we have said is that we're going to pay for it these.
Sorry, that was the wrong one. I thought that. Sorry about that.
Although Chris Wallace had Axelrod on, and those two went at it pretty hard.
Yeah, that was the one I was looking for. I thought we had that one, the Axelrod one. No, we don't have that. Sorry. Yeah, he was going after Axelrod about the whole Libya issue.
The briefings.
And the briefings that came up last week and whether, you know, I don't know. I thought the vice presidential candidates actually handled this one pretty well, but it didn't even come up, really, in the first debate. I mean, was that before? No, it wasn't before the Libya attack. It was after. It didn't come up.
Jim Lehrer really wanted to talk about domestic and economic policy. That was, like, the whole focus of everything he talked about.
Yeah.
And I guess I wasn't surprised that the vice presidential debate got into the foreign policy stuff, in part because of all the noise around what actually is happening with Benghazi and the Middle East and all the rest. But I think the other thing that drove it was that Biden spent a tremendous amount of time during his period in the Senate
on foreign affairs.
I think he was the ranking minority member and the chair back and forth. So, and people were wondering about whether Paul Ryan could speak to those issues because he was so focused when he was as a member of the House on the budget and tax stuff.
Do you think, though, that the administration intentionally downplayed the terrorism angle on this? Because what Joe Biden was saying was that we were reporting what we knew when we knew it, and we were originally told it was, you know, a rush on the embassy by protesters, not terrorists, although there's sort of a slim difference there.
Again, it's hard for me to interpret that. You know, what they're saying and what they're saying is that from the intelligence community, I think there was some confusion as to whether or not this was, you know, more planned, more calculated, or was it something erupting very quickly, as you've seen, you know, around the, you know, around the other protests in Egypt and other places earlier in the year. I think that when you get into this, I mean, I was thinking back to 9/11, you know, and thinking about how people did not politicize what had happened in 9/11, especially immediately afterwards. And again, there were reports that intelligence said we were about to be attacked. People didn't do that. And I think that it's important here, especially when you don't know all the facts. facts to sort of take this out of the realm of politics. It's one thing to talk about the overall policy, but I think it's very difficult when we still don't know all the facts to make this political. I think it's not
also,
a smart thing.
Also, for the GOP to be saying that we were under attack on September 11th and missed the warning signs, couldn't you turn that around and say, well, didn't George Bush miss the warning signs?
That's the point that I'm making, yeah, is that there are always warning signs. There are always different pieces of intelligence that you can get, both accurate and inaccurate. I mean, as it turns out, we went to the Iraq War on inaccurate intelligence assessments. And so I think that right now, especially with this attack, it's very difficult, I think, for especially Paul Ryan, who's been part of the U.S. House, when they cut spending for these types of budgetary expenditures to protect the embassies by $300 million. I just think they all need to sort of take a deep breath, sit back, and wait till all the facts come out.
Yeah, my only I hesitate to even talk about this because four really good, decent people, including one from here in Massachusetts, died as a result of all this. The most troubling part to me was Lamb's testimony before Congress, where the basic message was we had real-time, on-the-ground video and audio of everything that happened during that attack, which, based on every movie I've seen in the past 3 years that involves anything that has to do with our military and our security and our defenses, is completely and utterly believable. I mean, they're probably satellites watching us sit here right now. I find the fact that the administration carried that other message forward for over a week.
It makes no sense.
Bizarre.
Yeah, it makes no sense.
And that, I think, is, for me anyway, the most troubling.
It's very
part
disturbing,
of all.
The whole thing about the video, because I kept wondering, how could anybody get upset over something that was truly cartoonish? There have got to be things that
The guys at Benghazi had RPGs, for crying out loud. They were blown up automobiles.
Yeah,
right. I mean,
yeah, but people get mad at cartoons. Cartoons have killed people, you know, and that's ultimately, you know, something.
I think this is a really hard issue to talk about given the current political climate and the fact that people perish, but there's something that makes no sense to me at all about the way the administration's portrayed what they knew and when they knew it.
Something isn't right. All right, talking to former state treasurer and Democratic candidate for Governor Shannon O'Brien and Charlie Baker, entrepreneur in residence at General Catalyst Partners and former Republican candidate for governor. When we return after this, more politics as usual, and we've got the Senate race coming up. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Emily Rooney. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. It's politics as usual this Monday midday. I've got with me here in the studio Charlie Baker, a former Republican candidate for governor, and Shannon O'Brien, a former Massachusetts state treasurer and Democratic candidate for governor. So moving on to the Senate race, everything I've been reading, this is the most expensive, the most watched Senate race really in the country. It's hard to get my head around that because it feels very distant to me. Maybe that's why, because it's a national race, and it feels like we don't really have – we're not that close to the candidates here in Massachusetts. I mean, they've avoided local media except for advertisements. So it's – you know, it also feels very anecdotally like a completely blue-collar, white-collar. Somebody was at a football game and over the weekend, and everybody tailgating was voting for Scott Brown, and then somebody else was somewhere in their neighborhood over the weekend over in Dorchester, Roxbury, saying, oh, all their neighbors are voting for, Elizabeth Warren. So it's hard to kind of nail this one down.
I think I think part of the reason why you don't see both of them in the middle of the media every day or as much as you might like is because in a race that's this close, if somebody makes a mistake, there's a gigantic price to be paid for it. And I do think that, I do think there are, the next 3 weeks in this race will matter. This is not a race that's been decided one way or another. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, people talk about the fact that you get 3 weeks out and in a lot of instances, like the path of the race has been set. I really believe this one is one that, you know, could go down to the last couple of days with both candidates neck and neck.
I agree, but I can't speak about Scott Brown because I'm not getting 5,000 emails a day from the Scott Brown campaign. But, you know, I believe that Elizabeth Warren is out there pressing the flesh and going out there and meeting people. And the grassroots efforts that they're putting together, the door knocking, is pretty amazing. And, you know, in the polls, I think it's very, very close. They're now probably going to have, you know, maybe about the same amount of money to spend on the campaign. But what I think this campaign is really going to turn on is who has the best ground game. And ultimately, I think that there are a lot of people out there in the, you know, sort of more suburban independent areas of Massachusetts that are definitely supporting Scott Brown. But the issue is, can the Democrats turn this out? Will Scott Brown have the same kind of enthusiasm? Remember, he had Tea Party people coming from outside of the state, just driving to Massachusetts and showing up and looking for a headquarters. Will he be able to mimic that with the sort of institutional mm-hmm. support that he may have been able to put together now that he's an incumbent?
Well, everybody's saying, Charlie, that Brown really needs to outperform, you know, to overcome the basic yeah. math. That he's, you know, there's going to be a million more Democrats turning out to vote. How many of them are going to, you know, switch over to Scott Brown versus Elizabeth Warren, even if they're voting for Obama?
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I would say is Scott's already proven he can get Democrats to vote for him. He's done it in every election he's ever had. And, you know, I thought Marty Walsh's comment in the paper yesterday, there was a big story about the union organizing yeah. effort. And he said, I don't know a single member of any union who doesn't have family member and friends who are voting for Scott Brown, yeah. which is exactly right. And
the building traits.
It was the building.
Yeah, it's more the building traits. The other unions, not so much.
But I think he's going to get a lot of the police officers. He's been endorsed by most of the yeah. public safety unions. And I think Scott's always been capable of chasing 100% of the vote, and it's one of the things mm-hmm. I admire the most about him. And I think the ground game is going to matter, but I also think, you know, there are so many other factors that are going to be tied into what happens over the next 3 weeks. I think it's very hard to tell how this is all going to play out. Scott has to spend 3 days a week in Washington, which is too bad.
Yeah.
But that said, he's everywhere when he's home. I mean, I've never seen a guy who covers more territory than he does over the course of 4 days.
Yeah. His presence is everywhere. I was at a football game a few weeks ago, a Patriots game, and his presence was – I realize that's his neighborhood, but
– That's his Senate district.
Absolutely no presence.
His state Senate district.
But
I think that the biggest issue that if Elizabeth Warren can really focus on, and we're seeing this now, the balance of power in the United States Senate, you know, I think that when you think that this is not just what will the Senate do to impact the Supreme Court choices going forward, this is not just women's issues. It's cases like Citizens United. It's voting rights. It's cases that are going to impact men, women, children, seniors, black, white, red. And I believe that if she can turn this into that national race, not just in terms of the politics of it, but get people really thinking about those national issues and what it means to have a Republican Senate that will be maybe appointing the next Scalia, approving the next
Scalia.
Isn't that unbelievable,
Shannon, that here we are in the bluest state in the country, and you're saying that her basic approach to win this election has to be to nationalize it, that she can't win it based on Scott Brown against Elizabeth Warren, because Scott Brown is a bipartisan, moderate, independent guy who most people believe on most issues, takes him as he calls him as he sees him, and is perfectly happy to work with and support Democrats when he thinks they're right, and to work with and support Republicans in a country that's incredibly polarized, and in a nation capital where the biggest beef most independent voters have is nobody's ever willing to cross the aisle and get anything done.
But I actually believe that if he's elected to a 6-year term, he becomes far less bipartisan. I think that he has been on many votes bipartisan. He's been bipartisan on the ones that don't count. On the ones that count, he's been a lot less bipartisan. And I think that if he has a full 6-year term, I don't think that he's going to have the need to be as bipartisan as he has been.
Do you really believe that Professor Warren will ever vote for any Republican initiative on anything? I mean, she couldn't even name anybody in the Senate that she was willing to work with on the Republican side except a guy who lost his primary and is gone.
Yeah.
Well, again, I think that the reason I'm raising this as an issue is because I think Scott Brown opened the door to raise this issue. When he was asked who his model Supreme Court justice is, and it's Antonin Scalia, that
he was going by height.
Yeah, well, okay, height.
He
or,
probably
you
named
know.
The first name that came to mind.
Well, he named, that's named thing. Four.
He had to memorize all those
right.
guys.
But again, he didn't
him.
Answer the question. He said Scalia. He opened the door, and,
yeah,
it, and it does make you
but
realize.
But everybody forgets he voted for Sotomayor.
He voted against Elena Kagan. And if
that's
he
a great
thinks
line,
that,
he keeps saying, "I'm sorry, I didn't vote for your boss."
Yeah. Professor.
So I mean, you just brought this up though about the nationalizing. I mean. The other night when she was appealing, this always seems so Byzantine too, that you have to appeal to a certain quarter, the female vote. And she was saying, when she was really hammering that thing about Scott Brown had one opportunity to vote for equal pay and one opportunity.
On a bill that the Boston Globe editorialized against, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Is that effective? I mean, is this a female thing? Because I think Scott Brown is very attractive to a lot of female voters. I mean, he looked like a movie star the other night. It was actually, he's a good looking guy.
But you
look better than ever.
But I've heard people say, I'm voting for Mitt Romney because he's good looking. You know what I mean? Honest to God. And because he looks like he's a governor, he looks like he's a president. The fact is, when women look at who will vote on issues, and it's not just reproductive rights, it's not just can women get contraceptive, health care. It's not just those issues. It's other issues, economic justice, and I think that Elizabeth Warren has not, for part of the campaign, enunciated that as well as she could. It's not just about abortion. It's not just about choice. It's about other issues that women should care about. And I think she's hammering that home now.
I actually think my view on this one is that most women, I believe, are better team players than men. I've always felt that. In every work environment I've ever been in every community organization, in every fundraiser I've ever done for charities, I've always felt that women are just innately better team players than men. And I think what most of the women I know want more than anything is for Washington to grow up and stop behaving like children and start to make the decisions that make the most sense for the country instead of, sort of digging in on their end of the sandbox and refusing to cross over.
And
on that one, Scott's as good as anybody, and I would argue certainly better than his opponent.
But again, I think that I'll use the example of Hillary Clinton. A lot of people thought that she was kind of a polarizing figure, and she went in there and she worked in a bipartisan fashion. She had Republican senators remarking what a great job she did. I think that Elizabeth Warren will work in that same fashion, working across the aisle, making sure that she's representing Massachusetts well. I just
She's never been in office. I mean, this is a high bar to go for, mm-hmm. Senate. From professor at Harvard, from
it's also a high bar to go from being a backbench state senator who really never had much of a legislative record of accomplishment. Scott's a great guy. I knew Scott when I was in the legislature. I knew Scott when I was in law school. Not really well, sort of just as an acquaintance. And I think that the biggest issue for him is he's a nice guy. He's come across as a nice guy. He is well-spoken. He has, I think, done a pretty good job in this campaign, except in maybe a couple of the debates of maintaining that nice guy image. And I think that that's why people like him. It's that likability mm-hmm. factor.
Why do you think Ted Kennedy used to get so much stuff done when he was a U.S. senator? Because he was a nice guy with most of his colleagues down there. I mean, being a nice guy or a nice gal in a big body with a lot of people where you got to figure out a way to get 51 votes on anything. And in the Senate, you got to get 60.
He led on issues.
That's big.
And on health care. I mean, again, he led in a way on health care, on other issues. I mean, the fact is he worked with Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney now
Orrin Hatch was like his best friend.
But I know,
yeah,
but
exactly.
Mitt Romney has now walked away from
the power.
The one bit of bipartisan.
He had so much power he could afford to.
No, but,
nice
but I would argue that in a body that's, I don't know where the numbers are going to end up in the Senate, but it's pretty clear to me that a small handful of senators are going to have the ability, if they choose to exercise it, to get a lot of stuff done in the next few years. And they're going to need to. This country's in terrible trouble financially and
Alrighty.
Economically.
Thank you so much to Shannon O'Brien and Charlie Baker. That's our Politics as Usual segment this Monday. Thanks to you both.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Coming up, we're going to be talking to outgoing 4th Congressional District Congressman Barney Frank. had Barney Frank on the phone, and we lost the call, so he'll be checking back in. But I still have Shannon O'Brien and Charlie Baker here in the studio. So that district race, I mean, is that a done deal for Joe Kennedy III?
You never know. The only poll that matters is on election day, right? I've actually been spending almost all my time on the congressional side in my own district, where my former running mate and good friend Richard Tesei has a real chance to win.
Yeah, what's going to happen there?
I think Richard's going to win, and I think he should win, and I think he'll be a great congressman.
What are the most recent polling numbers up there?
It depends upon who you believe, but it's basically Richard hasn't been behind in any.
And he started raising
one
more money,
which I thought was weird. Yeah. But the DCC pulled out. That's the Democratic Congressional Committee pulled out $600,000 in advertising.
Well, over the weekend,
I think they decided
they didn't
have
the money.
No, I think they decided that Richard was going to win, and they'd be better off spending their money elsewhere.
That was very odd. That came out over the weekend. I couldn't quite follow that.
Although I think that the new ad that John Tierney has, where he's speaking directly to the camera, is actually a pretty effective ad. I don't know if it's enough to help it turn it around, but I thought it was a pretty good ad where he speaks directly, saying that they're attacking my wife, attacking my family, and rather than talking about our families, we should be talking about your family. I thought it was a pretty good ad.
You know, but this is, again, we've done some
he's not believable on this issue.
But you know, we've been up there a couple times to just cover that race, and yeah, maybe it's just the old, you know, the incumbent, he's my pal, but people still seem very, very close to him, that they think he's a good guy, and they're almost willing to forgive him this.
I think, well, we'll find out on Election Day. I mean, my view is that I think Richard is going to win, and I think he deserves to win. I think he's run a terrific campaign, and he will be a great congressman just because he's built that way. Mm-hmm. He'll be all over the district. He'll be huge.
He's been understated.
Oh, yeah. But his great strength is if you look at his favorability rankings among everybody, Democrats, Independents, Republicans, in his whole Senate district, everybody liked him. Yeah. And the reason why was because he's a good listener, and he gets stuff done, and he says he's going to do something, he does it.
All right. I'm told we now do have Congressman Barney Frank on the phone. So once again, Charlie Baker, Shannon O'Brien, thanks for being with us.
Take care.
We'll hold you to task on those predictions, Charlie.